of delight. Then she went back to sleep. He watched her for a while. Her face was perfect, small and pink and regular. But her way of life troubled him more and more. It seemed hard-hearted to use a child as her accomplice. If he talked to her about it, she got angry and told him that he was guilty too, for he was living here rent-free and eating the food she bought with her ill-gotten gains. He sighed and got up. Cora's home was the upstairs floor of a tumble-down building in a coal yard. The yard owner had once lived here, but when he prospered, he moved. Now he used the ground floor as an office and rented the upper floor to Cora. There were two rooms, a big bed in one and a table and chairs in the other. The bedroom was full of what Cora spent all her money on, clothes. Both Esther and Annie had owned two dresses, one for work and one for Sundays, but Cora had 8 or 10 different outfits, all in striking colours, yellow, red, bright green and rich brown. She had shoes to match each one, and as many stockings and gloves and handkerchiefs as a fine lady. He washed his face, dressed quickly, and left. A few minutes later he was at Dermot's house. The family were eating their breakfast porridge. Max smiled at the children. Every time he used Cora's cundum, he wondered if he would have children of his own some day. At times he thought he would like Cora to have his baby. Then he remembered how she lived and changed his mind. Mac refused a bowl of porridge, for he knew they could not spare it. Dermot, like Mac, was living off a woman. His wife washed pots in a coffee house in the evenings while he took care of the children. "You've got a letter," Dermot said, and handed Mac a sealed note. Mac recognized the handwriting. It was almost identical with his own. The letter was from Esther. He felt a stab of guilt. He was supposed to be saving money for her, but he was on strike and penniless. "Where's it to be today?" Dermot said. Every day Mac met his lieutenants at a different location. "The back bar of the Queen's Head Tavern," Mac replied. "I'll spread the word." Dermot put his hat on and went out. Mac opened his letter and began to read. It was full of news. Annie was pregnant, and if the child turned out to be a boy, they would call him Mac. For some reason, that brought tears to Mac's eyes. The Jamiesons were sinking a new coal pit in High Glen on the Hallam estate. They had dug fast, and Esther would be working there as a bearer within a few days. That news was surprising. Mac had heard Lizzie say she would never allow coal mining in High Glen. The Reverend Mr. York's wife had taken a fever and died. No shock there, she had always been sickly. And Esther was still determined to leave Hugh as soon as Mac could save the money. He folded the letter and pocketed it. He must not let anything undermine his determination. He would win the strike, then he would be able to save. He kissed Dermot's children and went along to the Queen's Head. His men were already arriving, and he got down to business right away. One Eye Wilson, a coal heaver who had been sent to check on new ships anchoring in the river, reported two coal carriers arrived on the morning tide.
"From Sunderland, both of them," he said. "I spoke to a sailor who came ashore for bread."
Mac turned to Charlie Smith.
"Go on board the ships and talk to the captains, Charlie. Explain why we're on strike and ask them to wait patiently. Say we hope the shippers will soon give in and allow the new gangs to uncoal the ships."
One Eye interjected.
"Why send a nigger? They might listen better to an Englishman."
"I am an Englishman," Charlie said indignantly.
Mac said, "Most of these captains were born in the northeast coalfield, and Charlie speaks with their accent. Anyway, he's done this sort of thing before, and he's proved himself a good ambassador." "No offence, Charlie," said One Eye.
Charlie shrugged and left to do his assigned task. A woman rushed in, pushing past him, and approached Mac's table, breathless and flustered. Mac recognized Sari, the wife of a bellicose coal heaver called Buster McBride.
"Mac, they've caught a sailor bringing a sack of coal ashore, and I'm afraid Buster will kill him."
"Where are they?"
"They've put him in the outhouse at the Swan and locked him in, but Buster's drinking and he wants to hang him upside down from the clock tower, and some of the others are egging him on."
This kind of thing happened constantly. The coal heavers were always on the edge of violence. So far, Mac had been able to rein them in. He picked a big, affable boy called Pigskin Pollard.
"Go along there and calm the boys down, Pigskin. The last thing we want is a murder." "I'm on my way," he said.
Casper Gordonson arrived with egg yolk on his shirt and a note in his hand.
"There's a barge train bringing coal to London along the River Lee. It should arrive at Enfield Lock this afternoon."
Enfield, Mac said. How far away is that?
12 miles,
Gordonson replied.
We can get there by midday, even if we walk.
Good. We must get control of the lock and prevent the barges passing. I'd like to go myself. I'll take 12 steady men. Another coal heaver came in.
Fat Sam Barrows, the landlord of the Green Man, is trying to recruit a gang to uncall the Spirit of Jarrow, he said.
He'd be lucky, Mac commented. Nobody likes Fat Sam. He's never paid honest wages in his life.
Still, we'd better keep an eye on the tavern, just in case. Will Trimble, go along there and snoop about. Let me know if there's any danger of Sam getting 16 men.
He's gone to ground, said Sidney Lennox. He's left his lodgings, and no one knows where he went.
Jay felt awful. He had told his father, in front of Sir Philip Armstrong, that he could locate McCash. He wished he had said nothing. If he failed to deliver on his promise, his father's scorn would be blistering. He had been counting on Lennox to know where to find McCash.
But if he's in hiding, how does he run the strike? He said.
He appears every morning at a different coffee house. Somehow his henchmen know where to go. He gives his orders and vanishes until the next day.
Someone must know where he lays his head, Jay said plaintively. If we can find him, we can smash this strike.
Lennox nodded. He more than anyone wanted to see the coal heavers defeated.
Well, Caspar Gordonson must know.
Jay shook his head. That's no use to us. Does McCash have a woman?
Yes, Cora. But she's as tough as a boot, she won't tell.
There must be someone else.
There's the kid, Lennox said thoughtfully.
Kid?
Quick Peg. She goes robbing with Cora. I wonder.
At midnight, Lord Archer's coffee house was packed with officers, gentlemen, and whores. The air was full of tobacco smoke and the smell of spilled wine. A fiddler was playing in a corner, but he could hardly be heard over the roar of 100 shouted conversations. Several card games were in progress, but Jay was not playing. He was drinking. The idea was for him to pretend to be drunk, and at first he had tipped most of his brandy down the front of his waistcoat. But as the evening wore on, he drank more, and now he did not have to make much effort to appear unsteady on his feet. Chip Marlborough had been drinking seriously from the start of the evening, but he never seemed to get drunk. Jay was too worried to enjoy himself. His father would never listen to excuses. Jay had to produce an address for McCash. He had toyed with the idea of making one up, then claiming McCash must have moved again, but he felt his father would know he was lying. So he was drinking in Archer's and hoping to meet Cora. During the course of the evening, numerous girls had approached him, but none fitted the description of Cora. Pretty face, flaming red hair, age about 19 or 20. Each time, he and Chip would flirt for a while until the girl realized they were not serious and moved on. Sidney Lennox was a watchful presence on the far side of the room, smoking a pipe and playing faro for low stakes. Jay was beginning to think they would be unlucky tonight. There were 100 girls like Cora in Covent Garden. He might have to repeat this performance tomorrow, and even the day after, before running into her. And he had a wife waiting at home who did not understand why he needed to spend the evening in a place where respectable ladies were not seen. Just as he was thinking wistfully of climbing into a warm bed and finding Lizzie there, eager and waiting, Cora came in. Jay was sure it was she. She was easily the prettiest girl in the room, and her hair really was the colour of the flames in the fireplace. She was dressed like a whore in a red silk dress with a low neckline and red shoes with bows, and she scanned the room with a professional gaze. Jay looked over at Lennox and saw him nod slowly twice. Thank God, he thought. He looked away, caught Cora's eye, and smiled. He saw a faint flash of recognition in her expression, as if she knew who he was. Then she smiled back and came over. Jay felt nervous and told himself that he only had to be charming. He had charmed 100 women. He kissed her hand. She wore a heady perfume with sandalwood in it.
I thought I knew every beautiful woman in London, but I was wrong, he said gallantly. I'm Captain Jonathan, and this is Captain Chip.
Jay had decided not to use his real name in case Mac had mentioned him to Cora. If she found out who he was, she would be sure to smell a rat.
"I'm Cora," she said, giving them a once-over look.
What a handsome pair. I can't decide which captain I like best.
Chip said, My family is nobler than Jay's. But mine's richer, said Jay, and for some reason that made them both giggle.
If you're so rich, buy me a measure of brandy, she said.
Jay waved at a waiter and offered her a seat. She squeezed in between him and Chip on the bench. He smelled gin on her breath. He looked down at her shoulders and the swell of her breasts. He could not help comparing her with his wife. Lizzie was short but voluptuous, with wide hips and a deep bosom. Cora was taller and more slender, and her breasts looked to him like two apples lying side by side in a bowl. Giving him a quizzical look, she said, Do I know you? He felt a stab of anxiety. Surely they had never met.
I don't think so, he said.
If she recognized him, the game would be up.
You look familiar. I know I've never spoken to you, but I've seen you.
Now's our chance to get to know one another, he said with a desperate smile. He put his arm over the back of the seat and stroked her neck. She closed her eyes as if she was enjoying it, and Jay began to relax. She was so convincing that he almost forgot she was pretending. She put a hand on his thigh, close to his crotch. He told himself not to enjoy this too much. He was supposed to be play-acting. He wished he had not drunk so much. He might need his wits about him. Her brandy came, and she drank it in a gulp.
Come on, big boy, she said. We'd better get some air before you burst out of those britches.
Jay realized he had a visible erection, and he blushed. Cora stood up and headed for the door, and Jay followed. When they were outside, she put her arm around his waist and led him along the colonnaded sidewalk of the Covent Garden Piazza. He draped an arm over her shoulder, then worked his hand into the bosom of her dress and played with her nipple. She giggled and turned into an alley. They embraced and kissed, and he squeezed both her breasts. He forgot all about Lennox and the plot. Cora was warm and willing, and he wanted her. Her hands were all over him, undoing his waistcoat, rubbing his chest, and diving into his breeches. He pushed his tongue into her mouth and tried to lift her skirts up at the same time. He felt cold air on his belly. From behind him there came a childish scream. Cora gave a start and pushed Jay away. She looked over his shoulder, then turned as if to run, but Chip Marlborough appeared and grabbed her before she took the first step. Jay turned around and saw Lennox struggling to keep hold of a screaming, scratching, wriggling child. As they struggled, the child dropped several objects. In the starlight, Jay recognized his own wallet and pocket watch, silk handkerchief and silver seal. She had been picking his pockets while he was kissing Cora. Even though he was expecting it, he had felt nothing. But he had entered very fully into the part he was playing. The child stopped struggling, and Lennox said, We're taking you two before a magistrate. Picking pockets is a hanging offence. Jay looked around, half expecting Cora's friends to come rushing to her defence. But no one had seen the scuffle in the alley. Chip glanced at Jay's crotch and said,
You can put your weapon away, Captain Jamison. The battle is over.
Most wealthy and powerful men were magistrates, and Sir George Jamison was no exception. Although he never held open court, he had the right to try cases at home. He could order offenders to be flogged, branded, or imprisoned, and he had the power to commit more serious offenders to the Old Bailey for trial. He was expecting Jay, so he had not gone to bed, but all the same he was irritable at having been kept up so late. I expected you around 10 o'clock, he said grumpily, when they all trooped into the drawing-room of the Grosvenor Square house. Cora, dragged in by Chip Marlborough, with her hands tied, said,
So you were expecting us? This was all planned, you evil pigs.
Sir George said, Shut your mouth, or I'll have you flogged around the square before we begin. Cora seemed to believe him, for she said no more. He drew paper towards him and dipped a pen in an inkwell. J. Jamison, Esquire, is the prosecutor. He complains that his pocket was picked by... Lennox said, She's called Quick Peg, sir. I can't write that down, Sir George snapped. What is your real name, child?
Peggy Knapp, sir.
And the woman's name?
Cora Higgins, said Cora.
Pocket picked by Peggy Knapp, accomplice Cora Higgins. The crime witnessed by... Sidney Lennox, keeper of the Sun Tavern in Wapping.
And Captain Marlborough?
Chip raised his hands in a defensive gesture.
I'd rather not get involved, if Mr. Lennox's evidence will suffice.
It surely will, Captain, said Sir George. He was always polite to Chip because he owed Chip's father money. Very good of you to assist in the apprehension of these thieves. Now, have the accused anything to say? Cora said, I'm not her accomplice. I've never seen her before in my life. Peg gasped and stared at Cora in disbelief, but Cora carried on.
I went for a walk with a handsome young man, that's all. I never knew she was picking his pockets.
Lennox said, the two are known associates, Sir George. I've seen them together many times. I've heard enough, Sir George said. You are both committed to Newgate Prison on charges of pickpocketing. Peg began to cry. Cora was white with fear.
Why are you all doing this? She said.
She pointed an accusing finger at Jay.
You were waiting for me in Archers.
She pointed at Lennox.
You followed us out. And you, Sir George Jamieson, stayed up late when you should be in bed to commit us. What's the point of it all? What have Peg and me ever done to you?
Sir George ignored her. Captain Marlborough obliged me by taking the woman outside and guarding her for a few moments. They all waited while Chip led Cora out and closed the door. Then Sir George turned to Peg. Now, child, what is the punishment for picking pockets? Do you know? She was pale and trembling.
The sheriff's collar, she whispered.
If you mean hanging, you're right. But did you know that some people are not hanged, but sent to America instead? The child nodded. They are people who have influential friends to plead for them and beg the judge to be merciful. Do you have influential friends? She shook her head. Well, now, what if I tell you that I will be your influential friend and intercede for you? She looked up at him, and hope gleamed in her little face. But you have to do something for me.
What?
She said. I will save you from hanging if you tell us where Mac McCash is living. The room was silent for a long moment.
In the attic over the coal yard in Wapping High Street,
she said, and she burst into tears. Chapter 22. Mac was surprised to wake up alone. Cora had never before stayed out until daybreak. He had been living with her for only 2 weeks, and he did not know all her habits, but all the same he was worried. He got up and followed his usual routine. He spent the morning at St. Luke's Coffee House, sending messages and receiving reports. He asked everyone if they had seen or heard of Cora, but no one had. He sent someone to the Sun Tavern to speak to Quick Peg, but she too had been out all night and had not returned. In the afternoon, he walked to Covent Garden and went around the taverns and coffee houses, questioning the whores and waiters. Several people had seen Cora last night. A waiter at Lord Archer's had noticed her leaving with a rich young drunk. After that, there was no trace. He went to Dermot's lodgings in Spitalfields, hoping for news. Dermot was feeding his children a broth made of bones for their supper. He had been asking after Cora all day and had heard nothing. Mac walked home in the dark, hoping that when he arrived at Cora's apartment over the coal yard, she would be there, lying on the bed in her underwear, waiting for him. But the place was cold and dark and empty. He lit a candle and sat brooding. Outside on Wapping High Street, the taverns were filling up. Although the coal heavers were on strike, they still found money for beer. Mac would have liked to join them, but for safety he did not show his face in the taverns at night. He ate some bread and cheese and read a book Gordonson had loaned him, a novel called Tristram Shandy, but he could not concentrate. Late in the evening, when he was beginning to wonder if Cora was dead, there was a commotion in the street outside. He heard men shouting and the noise of running feet, and what sounded like several horses and carts. Fearing that the coal heavers might start some kind of fracas, he went to the window. The sky was clear and there was a half moon, so Mac could see all along the high street. 10 or 12 horse-drawn carts were lumbering down the uneven dirt road in the moonlight, evidently headed for the coal yard. A crowd of men followed the carts, jeering and shouting, and more spilled out of the taverns and joined them at every corner. The scene had all the makings of a riot. Mac cursed. It was the last thing he wanted. He turned from the window and rushed down the stairs. If he could talk to the men with the carts and persuade them not to unload, he might avert violence. When he reached the street, the first cart was turning into the coal yard. As he ran forward, the men jumped off the carts and, without warning, began to throw lumps of coal at the crowd. Some of the heavers were hit. Others picked up the lumps of coal and threw them back. Mac heard a woman scream and saw children being herded indoors.
"Stop!"
he yelled. He ran between the coal heavers and the carts with his hands held up.
"Stop!"
The men recognized him, and for a moment there was quiet. He was grateful to see Charlie Smith's face in the crowd.
"Try to keep order here, Charlie, for God's sake," he said. "I'll talk to these people." "Everybody stay calm," Charlie called out. "Leave it to Mac."
Mac turned his back on the heavers. On either side of the narrow street, people were standing on house doorsteps, curious to see what was happening, but ready to duck quickly inside. There were at least 5 men on each coal cart. In the unnatural silence, Mac approached the lead cart.
"Who's in charge here?" he said.
A figure stepped forward in the moonlight.
"I am."
Mac recognized Sidney Lennox. He was shocked and puzzled. What was going on here? Why was Lennox trying to deliver coal to a yard? He had a cold premonition of disaster. He spotted the owner of the yard, Jack Cooper, known as Black Jack because he was always covered in black dust like a miner.
"Jack, close up the gates of your yard, for God's sake," he pleaded. "There'll be murder done if you let this go on."
Cooper looked sulky.
"I've got to make a living." "You will as soon as the strike is over. You don't want to see bloodshed on Wapping High Street, do you?"
"I've set my hand to the plough and I'll not look back now."
Mac gave him a hard look.
"Who asked you to do this, Jack? Is there someone else involved?"
"I'm my own man. No one tells me what to do."
Mac began to see what was happening, and it made him angry. He turned to Lennox.
"You've paid him off. But why?"
They were interrupted by the sound of a handbell being rung loudly. Mac turned to see 3 people standing at the upstairs window of the Frying Pan Tavern. One was ringing the bell, another holding a lantern. The third man, in the middle, wore the wig and sword that marked him as someone of importance. When the bell stopped ringing, the third man announced himself.
"I am Roland MacPherson, a justice of the peace in Wapping, and I hereby declare a riot."
He went on to read the key section of the Riot Act. Once a riot had been declared, everyone had to disperse within an hour. Defiance was punishable by death. The magistrate had got here quickly, Mac thought. Clearly he had been expecting this and waiting in the tavern for his cue. The whole episode had been carefully planned. But to what end? It seemed to him they wanted to provoke a riot that would discredit the coal heavers and give them a pretext to hang the ringleaders. And that meant him. His first reaction was aggressive. He wanted to yell,
"If they're asking for a riot, by God, we'll give them one they'll never forget. We'll burn London before we've done."
He wanted to get his hands around Lennox's throat. But he forced himself to be calm and think clearly. How could he frustrate Lennox's plan? His only hope was to give in and let the coal be delivered. He turned to the coal heavers, gathered in an angry crowd around the open gates of the yard.
"Listen to me," he began. "This is a plot to provoke us into a riot. If we all go home peacefully, we will outwit our enemies. If we stay and fight, we're lost."
There was a rumble of discontent.
"Dear God," Mac thought, "these men are stupid." "Don't you understand," he said. "They want an excuse to hang some of us. Why give them what they want? Let's go home tonight and fight on tomorrow."
"He's right," Charlie piped up. "Look who's here. Sidney Lennox. He's up to no good, we can be sure of that."
Some of the coal heavers were nodding agreement now, and Mac began to think he might persuade them. Then he heard Lennox's voice yell,
"Get him!"
Several men came at Mac at once. He turned to run, but one tackled him, and he crashed to the muddy ground. As he struggled, he heard the coal heavers roar, and he knew that what he had dreaded was about to begin, a pitched battle. He was kicked and punched, but he hardly felt the blows as he struggled to get up. Then the men attacking him were thrown aside by coal heavers, and he regained his feet. He looked around swiftly. Lennox had vanished. The rival gangs filled the narrow street. He saw fierce hand-to-hand fighting on all sides. The horses bucked and strained in their traces, neighing in terror. His instincts made him want to join in the fray and start knocking people down, but he held himself back. What was the quickest way to end this? He tried to think fast. The coal heavers would not retreat. It was against their nature. The best bet might be to get them into a defensive position and hope for a standoff. He grabbed Charlie.
"We'll try to get inside the coal yard and close the gates on him," he said. "Tell the men."
Charlie ran from man to man, spreading the order, shouting at the top of his voice to be heard over the noise of the battle.
"Inside the yard and close the gates! Keep them out of the yard!"
Then, to his horror, Mac heard the bang of a musket.
"What the hell is going on?"
he said, although no one was listening.
"Since when did coal drivers carry firearms? Who were these people?"
He saw a blunderbuss, a musket with a shortened barrel, pointed at him. Before he could move, Charlie snatched the gun, turned it on the man who held it, and shot him at point-blank range. The man fell dead. Mac cursed. Charlie could hang for that. Someone rushed him. Mac sidestepped and swung a fist. His blow landed on the point of the chin, and the man fell down. Mac backed away and tried to think. The whole thing was taking place right outside Mac's window. That must have been intentional. They had found out his address somehow. Who had betrayed him? The first shots were followed by a ragged tattoo of gunfire. Flashes lit up the night, and the smell of gunpowder mingled with the coal dust in the air. Mac cried out in protest as several coal heavers fell dead or wounded. Their wives and widows would blame him, and they would be right. He had started something he could not control. Most of the coal heavers got into the yard, where there was a supply of coal to throw. They fought frenziedly to keep the coal drivers out. The yard walls gave them cover from the musket fire that rattled intermittently. The hand-to-hand fighting was fiercest at the yard entrance, and Mac saw that if he could get the high wooden gates closed, the entire battle might peter out. He fought his way through the melee, got behind one of the heavy timber gates, and started to push. Some of the coal heavers saw what he was attempting and joined in. The big gate swept several scuffling men out of the way, and Mac thought they would get it shut in a moment. Then it was blocked by a cart. Gasping for breath, Mac shouted, "Move the cart! Move the cart!" His plan was already having some effect, he saw with an access of hope. The angled gate made a partial barrier between the two sides. Furthermore, the first excitement of the battle had passed, and the men's zest for fighting had been tempered by injuries and bruises and the sight of some of their comrades lying dead or wounded. The instinct of self-preservation was reasserting itself, and they were looking for ways to disengage with dignity. Mac began to think that he might end the fighting soon. If the confrontation could be stalled before someone called out the troops, the whole thing might be perceived as a minor skirmish, and the strike could continue to be seen as a mainly peaceful protest. A dozen coal heavers began to drag the cart out of the yard while others pushed the gates. Someone cut the horse's traces, and the frightened beast ran around in a panic, neighing and kicking.
"Keep pushing! Don't stop!"
Mac yelled as huge lumps of coal rained down on them. The cart inched out, and the gates closed the gap with maddening slowness. Then Mac heard a noise that wiped out all his hopes at a stroke. The sound of marching feet. The guards marched down Wapping High Street, their white and red uniforms gleaming in the moonlight. Jay rode at the head of the column, keeping his horse close-reined at a brisk walk. He was about to get what he had said he wanted. Action. He kept his face expressionless, but his heart was pounding. He could hear the roar of the battle Lennox had started, men shouting, horses neighing, muskets banging. Jay had never yet used a sword or gun in anger. Tonight would be his first engagement. He told himself that a rabble of coal heavers would be terrified of a disciplined and trained troop of guards, but he found it hard to be confident. Colonel Cranborough had given him this assignment and sent him out without a superior officer. Normally, Cranborough would have commanded the detachment himself, but he knew this was a special situation with heavy political interference, and he wanted to keep out of it. Jay had been pleased at first, but now he wished he had an experienced superior to help him. Lennox's plan had sounded foolproof in theory, but as he rode to battle, Jay found it full of holes. What if McCash were somewhere else tonight? What if he escaped before Jay could arrest him? As they approached the coal yard, the pace of the march seemed to slow, until Jay felt they were creeping forward by inches. Seeing the soldiers, many of the rioters fled and others took cover. But some threw coal, and a rain of lumps came down on Jay and his men. Without flinching, they marched up to the coal yard gates and, as prearranged, took up their firing positions. There would be only one volley. They were so close to the enemy that they would not have time to reload. Jay raised his sword. The coal heavers were trapped in the yard. They had been trying to close the yard gates, but now they gave up, and the gates swung fully open. Some scrambled over the walls, others tried pathetically to find cover among the heaps of coal or behind the wheels of a cart. It was like shooting chickens in a coop. Suddenly McCash appeared on top of the wall, a broad-shouldered figure, his face lit by the moon.
"Stop!"
he yelled.
"Don't shoot!"
"Go to hell," Jay thought. He swept his sword down and shouted,
"Fire!"
The muskets cracked like thunder. A pall of smoke appeared and hid the soldiers for a moment. 10 or 12 coal heavers fell, some shouting in pain, others deathly silent. McCash jumped down from the wall and knelt by the motionless, blood-soaked body of a Negro. He looked up and met Jay's eye, and the rage in his face chilled Jay's blood. Jay shouted,
"Charge!"
The coal heavers engaged the guards aggressively, surprising Jay. He had expected them to flee, but they dodged swords and muskets to grapple hand to hand, fighting with sticks and lumps of coal and fists and feet. Jay was dismayed to see several uniforms fall. He looked around for McCash and could not see him. Jay cursed. The whole purpose of this was to arrest McCash. That was what Sir Philip had asked for, and Jay had promised to deliver. Surely he had not slipped away. Then suddenly McCash was in front of him. Instead of running away, the man was coming after Jay. McCash grabbed Jay's bridle. Jay lifted his sword, and McCash ducked around to Jay's left side. Jay struck awkwardly and missed. McCash jumped up, grabbed Jay's sleeve, and pulled. Jay tried to jerk his arm back, but McCash would not let go. With dreadful inevitability, Jay slid sideways in his saddle. McCash gave a mighty heave and pulled him off his horse. Suddenly, Jay feared for his life. He managed to land on his feet. McCash's hands were around his throat in an instant. He drew back his sword, but before he could strike, McCash lowered his head and butted Jay's face brutally. Jay went blind for a moment and felt hot blood on his face. He swung his sword wildly. It connected with something, and he thought he had wounded McCash, but the grip on his throat did not slacken. His vision returned, and he looked into McCash's eyes and saw murder there. He was terrified, and if he could have spoken, he would have begged for mercy. One of his men saw him in trouble and swung the butt of a musket. The blow hit McCash on the ear. For a moment his grip slackened. Then it became tighter than ever. The soldier swung again. McCash tried to duck, but he was not quick enough, and the heavy wooden stock of the gun connected with a crack that could be heard over the roar of the battle. For a split second, McCash's stranglehold increased, and Jay struggled for air like a drowning man. Then McCash's eyes rolled up in his head. His hand slipped from Jay's neck, and he slumped to the ground unconscious. Jay drew breath raggedly and leaned on his sword. Slowly his terror eased. His face hurt like fire. His nose must be broken. But as he looked at the man crumpled on the ground at his feet, he felt nothing but satisfaction. Chapter 23. Lizzie did not sleep that night. Jay had told her there might be trouble, and she sat in their bedroom waiting for him, with a novel open but unread on her knee. He came home in the early hours with blood and dirt all over him and a bandage on his nose. She was so pleased to see him alive that she threw her arms around him and hugged him, ruining her white silk robe. She woke the servants and ordered hot water, and he told her the story of the riot bit by bit as she helped him out of his filthy uniform and washed his bruised body, and got him a clean nightshirt. Later, when they were lying side by side in the big four-poster bed, she said tentatively,
"Do you think McCash will be hanged?"
"I certainly hope so," Jay said, touching his bandage with a careful finger. "We have witnesses to say he incited the crowd to riot and personally attacked officers. I can't imagine a judge giving him a light sentence in the present climate. If he had influential friends to plead for him, it would be a different matter." She frowned.
"I never thought of him as a particularly violent man." Insubordinate, disobedient, insolent, arrogant, but not savage.
Jay looked smug.
You may be right, but things were arranged so that he had no choice.
What do you mean?
Sir Philip Armstrong paid a clandestine visit to the warehouse to speak to me and Father. He told us he wanted McCash arrested for rioting. He practically told us to make it happen. So Lennox and I arranged a riot.
Lizzie was shocked. It made her feel even worse to think that Mac had been deliberately provoked.
And is Sir Philip pleased with what you've done?
He is, and Colonel Cranborough was impressed by the way I handled the riot. I can resign my commission and leave the army with an unimpeachable reputation.
Jay made love to her then, but she was too troubled to enjoy his caresses. Normally she liked to romp around the bed, rolling him over and getting on top sometimes, changing positions, kissing and talking and laughing. And naturally he noticed that she was different. When it was over, he said,
"You're very quiet."
She thought of an excuse.
"I was afraid of hurting you."
He accepted that, and a few moments later he was asleep. Lizzie lay awake. It was the second time she had been shocked by her husband's attitude to justice, and both occasions had involved Lennox. Jay was not vicious, she was sure, but he could be led into evil by others, particularly strong-minded men such as Lennox. She was glad they were leaving England in a month's time. Once they set sail, they would never see Lennox again. Still, she could not sleep. There was a cold, leaden feeling in the pit of her stomach. Mac McCash was going to be hanged. She had been revolted to watch the hanging of total strangers that morning when she had gone to Tyburn Cross in disguise. The thought of the same thing happening to her childhood friend was unbearable. Mac was not her problem, she told herself. He had run away, broken the law, gone on strike, and taken part in a riot. He had done all he could to get into trouble. It was not her responsibility to rescue him now. Her duty was to the husband she had married. It was all true, but still she could not sleep. When the light of dawn began to show around the edges of the curtain, she got up. She decided to begin packing for the voyage, and when the servants appeared, she told them to start filling the waterproof trunk she had bought with her wedding presents: table linen, cutlery, china and glassware, cooking pots and kitchen knives. Jay woke up aching and bad-tempered. He drank a shot of brandy for breakfast and went off to his regiment. Lizzie's mother, who was still living at the Jamieson's house, called on Lizzie soon after Jay left, and the two of them went to the bedroom and began folding Lizzie's stockings and petticoats and handkerchiefs.
"What ship will you travel on?"
Mother asked.
"The Rosebud. She's a Jamieson vessel. And when you reach Virginia, how will you get to the plantation?" Ocean-going ships can sail up the Rappahannock River all the way to Fredericksburg, which is only 10 miles from Mockjack Hall.
Lizzie could see that her mother was anxious about her undertaking a long sea voyage.
"Don't worry, Mother. There are no pirates any more. You must take your own fresh water and keep the barrel in your cabin. Don't share with the crew. I'll make up a medicine chest for you in case of sickness." "Thank you, Mother."
Because of the cramped quarters, contaminated food and stale water, Lizzie was much more likely to die of some shipboard illness than be attacked by pirates.
"How long will it take?"
6 or 7 weeks.
Lizzie knew that was a minimum. If the ship was blown off course, the voyage could stretch to 3 months. Then the chance of sickness was much greater. However, she and Jay were young and strong and healthy, and they would survive.
And it would be an adventure.
She could hardly wait to see America. It was a whole new continent, and everything would be different. The birds, the trees, the food, the air, the people. She tingled whenever she thought about it. She had been living in London for 4 months, and she disliked it more every day. Polite society bored her to death. She and Jay often dined with other officers and their wives, but the officers talked of card games and incompetent generals, and the women were interested only in hats and servants. Lizzie found it impossible to make small talk, but if she spoke her mind, she always shocked them. Once or twice a week, she and Jay dined at Grosvenor Square. There, at least, the conversation was about something real: business, politics, and the wave of strikes and disturbances that had washed over London this spring. But the Jamiesons' view of events was completely one-sided. Sir George would rail against the working men, Robert would forecast disaster, and Jay would propose a clampdown by the military. No one, not even Alicia, had the imagination to see the conflict from the point of view of the other side. Lizzie did not think the working men were right to strike, of course, but she believed they had reasons which seemed strong to them. That possibility was never admitted around the highly polished dining table at Grosvenor Square.
"I expect you'll be glad to go back to High Glen House,"
Lizzie said to her mother. Mother nodded.
"The Jamiesons are very kind, but I miss my home, humble though it is."
End of side 11. Side 12. Lizzie was putting her favourite books into a trunk. Robinson Crusoe, Tom Jones, Roderick Random, all stories of adventure, when a footman knocked and said that Caspar Gordonson was downstairs. She asked the man to repeat the visitor's name, because she could hardly believe Gordonson would dare to call on any member of the Jamieson family. She should have refused to see him, she knew. He had encouraged and supported the strike that was damaging her father-in-law's business. But curiosity got the better of her, as ever, and she told the footman to show him into the drawing-room. However, she had no intention of making him welcome. "You've caused a great deal of trouble," she said as she walked in. To her surprise, he was not the aggressive, know-it-all bully she had expected, but an untidy, short-sighted man with a high-pitched voice and the manner of an absent-minded schoolteacher.
"I'm sure I didn't mean to," he said. "That is, I did, of course, but not to you, personally. Why have you come here? If my husband were at home, he would throw you out on your ear. Mac McCash has been charged under the Riot Act and committed to Newgate Prison. He will be tried at the Old Bailey in 3 weeks' time. It's a hanging offence."
The reminder struck Lizzie like a blow, but she hid her feelings.
"I know," she said coldly. "Such a tragedy. A strong young man with his life in front of him." "You must feel guilty," Gordonson said.
"You insolent fool," she blazed. "Who encouraged McCash to think he was a free man? Who told him he had rights? You! You're the one who should feel guilty."
"I do," he said quietly.
She was surprised. She had expected a hot denial. His humility calmed her. Tears came to her eyes, but she fought them back.
"He should have stayed in Scotland. You realize that many people who are convicted of capital offences don't hang in the end?"
"Yes."
There was still hope, of course. Her spirits lifted a little.
"Do you think Mac will get a royal pardon?"
"It depends who is willing to speak for him. Influential friends are everything in our legal system. I will plead for his life, but my words won't count for much. Most judges hate me. However, if you would plead for him..."
"I can't do that," she protested. "My husband is prosecuting McCash. It would be dreadfully disloyal of me."
"You could save his life."
"But it would make Jay look such a fool." "Don't you think he might understand?"
"No, I know he wouldn't. No husband would."
"Think about it."
"I won't. I'll do something else. I'll..."
She cast about for ideas.
"I'll write to Mr. York, the pastor of the church in Hugh. I'll ask him to come to London and plead for Mac's life at the trial."
Gordonson said,
"A country parson from Scotland? I don't think he'll have much influence. The only way to be certain is for you to do it yourself."
"It's out of the question."
"I won't argue with you. It will only make you more determined,"
Gordonson said shrewdly. He went to the door.
"You can change your mind at any time. Just come to the Old Bailey 3 weeks from tomorrow. Remember that his life may depend on it."
He went out, and Lizzie let herself cry. Mac was in one of the common wards of Newgate Jail. He could not remember all that had happened to him the night before. He had a dazed recollection of being tied up and thrown across the back of a horse and carried through London. There was a tall building with barred windows, a cobbled courtyard, a staircase, and a studded door. Then he had been led in here. It had been dark, and he had not been able to see much. Battered and fatigued, he had fallen asleep. He woke to find himself in a room about the size of Cora's apartment. It was cold. There was no glass in the windows and no fire in the fireplace. The place smelled foul. At least 30 other people were crammed in with him. Men, women, and children, plus a dog and a pig. Everyone slept on the floor and shared a large chamber pot. There was constant coming and going. Some of the women left early in the morning, and Mac learned they were not prisoners, but prisoners' wives, who bribed the jailers and spent nights here. The warders brought in food, beer, gin, and newspapers for those who could pay their grossly inflated prices. People went to see friends in other wards. One prisoner was visited by a clergyman, another by a barber. Anything was permitted, it seemed, but everything had to be paid for. People laughed about their plight and joked about their crimes. There was an air of jollity that annoyed Mac. He was hardly awake before he was offered a swallow of gin from someone's bottle and a puff on a pipe of tobacco, as if they were all at a wedding. Mac hurt all over, but his head was the worst. There was a lump at the back that was crusted with blood. He felt hopelessly gloomy. He had failed in every way. He had run away from Hugh to be free, yet he was in jail. He had fought for the coal heavers' rights and had got some of them killed. He had lost Cora. He would be put on trial for treason or riot or murder, and he would probably die on the gallows. Many of the people around him had as much reason to grieve, but perhaps they were too stupid to grasp their fate. Poor Esther would never get out of the village now. He wished he had brought her with him. She could have dressed as a man, the way Lizzie Hallam did. She would have managed sailor's work more easily than Mac himself, for she was nimbler, and her common sense might even have kept Mac out of trouble. He hoped Annie's baby would be a boy. At least there would still be a Mac. Perhaps Mac Lee would have a luckier life, and a longer one, than Mac McCash. He was at a low point when a warder opened the door, and Cora walked in. Her face was dirty and her red dress was torn, but she still looked ravishing, and everyone turned to stare. Mac sprang to his feet and embraced her, to cheers from the other prisoners.
"What happened to you?" he said.
"I was done for picking pockets, but it was all on account of you," she said.
"What do you mean?"
"It was a trap. He looked like any other rich young drunk, but he was Jade Jamieson. They nabbed us and took us in front of his father. It's a hanging offence, picking pockets, but they offered Peg a pardon if she would tell them where you lived."
Mac suffered a moment of anger with Peg for betraying him, but she was just a child, she could not be blamed.
"So that was how they found out. What happened to you?"
He told her the story of the riot. When he had done, she said,
"By Christ, McCash, you're an unlucky man to know."
It was true, he thought. Everyone he met got into some kind of trouble.
"Charlie Smith is dead," he said. "You must talk to Peg," she said. "She thinks you must hate her." "I hate myself for getting her into this."
Cora shrugged. "You didn't tell her to thief. Come on." She banged on the door and a warder opened it. She gave him a coin, jerked a thumb at Mac and said, "He's with me." The warder nodded and let them out. She led him along a corridor to another door and they entered a room very like the one they had left. Peg was sitting on the floor in a corner. When she saw Mac, she stood up, looking scared.
"I'm sorry," she said. "They made me do it. I'm sorry."
"It wasn't your fault," he said.
Her eyes filled with tears.
"I let you down," she whispered.
"Don't be silly."
He took her in his arms, and her tiny frame shook as she sobbed and sobbed. Caspar Gordonson arrived with a banquet. Fish soup in a big tureen, a joint of beef, new bread, several jugs of ale, and a custard. He paid the jailer for a private room with table and chairs. Mac, Cora, and Peg were brought from their ward, and they all sat down to eat. Mac was hungry, but he found he had little appetite. He was too worried. He wanted to know what Gordonson thought of his chances at the trial. He forced himself to be patient and drank some beer. When they had finished eating, Gordonson's servant cleared away and brought pipes and tobacco. Gordonson took a pipe, and so did Peg, who was addicted to this adult vice. Gordonson began by talking about Peg and Cora's case.
"I've spoken with the Jamieson family lawyer about the pickpocketing charge," he began. "Sir George will stand by his promise to ask for mercy for Peg."
"That surprises me," said Mac. "It's not like the Jamiesons to keep their word."
"Ah, well, they want something," Gordonson said. "You see, it will be embarrassing for them if Jay tells the court he picked Cora up, thinking she was a prostitute. So they want to pretend she just met him in the street and got him talking while Peg picked his pocket." Peg said scornfully. "And we're supposed to go along with this fairy tale and protect Jay's reputation."
"If you want Sir George to plead for your life, yes."
Cora said, "We have no choice. Of course we'll do it."
"Good." Gordonson turned to Mac. "I wish your case was so easy."
Mac protested.
"But I didn't riot."
"You didn't go away after the Riot Act was read."
"For God's sake, I tried to get everyone to go, but Lennox's ruffians attacked."
"Let's look at this step by step."
Mac took a deep breath and suppressed his exasperation.
"All right."
"The prosecutor will say simply that the Riot Act was read and you did not go away, so you are guilty and should be hanged."
"Yes, but everyone knows there's more to it than that."
"There. That's your defence. You simply say that the prosecutor has told half the story. Can you bring witnesses to say that you pleaded with everyone to disperse?"
"I'm sure I can. Dermot Riley can get any number of coal heavers to testify. But we should ask the Jamisons why the coal was being delivered to that yard, of all places, and at that time of night."
"Well..."
Mac banged the table impatiently.
"The whole riot was prearranged. We have to say that."
"It would be hard to prove."
Mac was infuriated by Gordonson's dismissive attitude.
"The riot was caused by a conspiracy. Surely you're not going to leave that out. If the facts don't come out in court, where will they?"
Peg said,
"Will you be at the trial, Mr. Gordonson?"
"Yes, but the judge may not let me speak."
"For God's sake, why not?"
Mac said indignantly.
"The theory is that if you're innocent, you don't need legal expertise to prove it. But sometimes judges make exceptions."
"I hope we get a friendly judge," Mac said anxiously.
"The judge ought to help the accused. It's his duty to make sure the defence case is clear to the jury. But don't rely on it. Place your faith in the plain truth. It's the only thing that can save you from the hangman."
Chapter 24. On the day of the trial, the prisoners were awakened at 5 o'clock in the morning. Dermot Riley arrived a few minutes later with a suit for Mac to borrow. It was the outfit Dermot had got married in, and Mac was touched. He also brought a razor and a sliver of soap. Half an hour later, Mac looked respectable and felt ready to face the judge. With Cora and Peg and 15 or 20 others, he was tied up and marched out of the prison, along Newgate Street, down a side street called Old Bailey, and up an alley to the Sessions House. Caspar Gordonson met him there and explained who was who. The yard in front of the building was already full of people. Prosecutors, witnesses, jurors, lawyers, friends and relatives, idle spectators, and probably whores and thieves looking for business. The prisoners were led across the yard and through a gate to the bail dock. It was already half full of defendants, presumably from other prisons, the Fleet Prison, the Bridewell, and Ludgate Prison. From there, Mac could see the imposing Sessions House. Stone steps led up to its ground floor, which was open on one side except for a row of columns. Inside was the judge's bench on a high platform. On either side were railed-off spaces for jurors and balconies for court officers and privileged spectators. It reminded Mac of a theatre, but he was the villain of the piece. He watched with grim fascination as the court began its long day of trials. The first defendant was a woman accused of stealing 15 yards of linsey woolsey, cheap cloth made of a mixture of linen and wool, from a shop. The shopkeeper was the prosecutor, and he valued the cloth at 15 shillings. The witness, an employee, swore that the woman picked up the bolt of cloth and went to the door, then, realizing she was observed, dropped the material and ran away. The woman claimed she had only been looking at the cloth and had never intended to make off with it. The jurors went into a huddle. They came from the social class known as the middling sort. They were small traders, well-to-do craftsmen, and shopkeepers. They hated disorder and theft, but they mistrusted the government and jealously defended liberty, their own at least. They found her guilty, but valued the cloth at 4 shillings, a lot less than it was worth. Gordonson explained that she could be hanged for stealing goods worth more than 5 shillings from a shop. The verdict was intended to prevent the judge from sentencing the woman to death. She was not sentenced immediately, however. The sentences would all be read out at the end of the day. The whole thing had taken no more than a quarter of an hour.
The following cases were dealt with equally rapidly, few taking more than half an hour. Cora and Peg were tried together at about mid-afternoon. Mac knew that the course of the trial was preordained, but still he crossed his fingers and hoped it would go according to plan. J. Jamison testified that Cora had engaged him in conversation in the street while Peg picked his pockets. He called Sidney Lennox as the witness who had seen what was happening and warned him. Neither Cora nor Peg challenged this version of events. Their reward was the appearance of Sir George, who testified that they had been helpful in the apprehension of another criminal and asked the judge to sentence them to transportation rather than hanging. The judge nodded sympathetically, but the sentence would not be pronounced until the end of the day. Mac's case was called a few minutes later. Lizzie could think of nothing but the trial. She had dinner at 3 o'clock, and, as Jay was at the court all day, her mother came to dine and keep her company.
"You're looking quite plump, my dear," Lady Hallam said. "Have you been eating a lot?"
"On the contrary," Lizzie said. "Sometimes food makes me feel ill. It's all the excitement of going to Virginia, I suppose. And now this dreadful trial." "It's not your concern," Lady Hallam said briskly. "Dozens of people are hanged every year for much less dreadful crimes. He can't be reprieved just because you knew him as a child."
"How do you know he committed a crime at all?"
If he did not, he will be found not guilty. I'm sure he is being treated the same as anyone foolish enough to get involved in a riot."
"But he isn't," Lizzie protested. "Jay and Sir George deliberately provoked that riot so that they could arrest Mac and finish the coalheaver strike. Jay told me." "Then I'm sure they had good reason."
Tears came to Lizzie's eyes.
"Mother, don't you think it's wrong?" "I'm quite sure it's none of my business or yours, Lizzie," she said firmly.
Wanting to hide her distress from her mother, Lizzie ate a spoonful of dessert, apples mashed with sugar, but it made her feel sick, and she put her spoon down.
"Caspar Cortenson said I could save Mac's life if I would speak for him in court."
"Heaven forbid!" Mother was shocked. "That you should go against your own husband in a public courtroom, don't even speak of it. But it's a man's life. Think of his poor sister, how she will grieve when she finds out he's been hanged." "My dear, they are minors. They aren't like us. Life is cheap. They don't grieve as we do. His sister will just get drunk on gin and go back down the pit."
"You don't really believe that, Mother, I know."
"Perhaps I'm exaggerating, but I'm quite sure it does no good to worry about such things. I just can't help it. He's a brave young man who only wanted to be free, and I can't bear the thought of him hanging from that rope."
"You could pray for him."
"I do,"
Lizzie said.
"I do."
The prosecutor was a lawyer, Augustus Pym.
"He does a lot of work for the government,"
Gordonson whispered to Mac.
"They must be paying him to prosecute this case."
So the government wanted Mac hanged. That made him feel low. Gordonson approached the bench and addressed the judge.
"My lord, as the prosecution is to be done by a professional lawyer, will you allow me to speak for Mr. McCash?"
"Certainly not," said the judge. "If McCash cannot convince the jury unless he has outside help, he can't have much of a case."
Mac's throat was dry, and he could hear his heartbeat. He was going to have to fight for his life alone. Well, he would fight every inch of the way. Pym began.
"On the day in question, a delivery of coal was being made to the yard of Mr. John Cooper, known as Black Jack, in Wapping High Street."
Mac said, "It wasn't day, it was night."
The judge said,
"Don't make foolish remarks."
"It's not foolish," Mac said. "Whoever heard of coal being delivered at 11 o'clock at night?"
"Be quiet. Carry on, Mr. Pym."
"The delivery men were attacked by a group of striking coal heavers, and the Wapping magistrates were alerted."
"Who by?" said Mac.
Pym answered,
"By the landlord of the Frying Pan Tavern, Mr. Harold Nipper."
"An undertaker," said Mac.
The judge said,
"And a respectable tradesman, I believe."
Pym went on.
"Mr. Roland McPherson, justice of the peace, arrived and declared a riot. The coal heavers refused to disperse."
"We were attacked," Mac said.
They ignored him.
"Mr. McPherson then summoned the troops, as was his right and duty. a detachment of the 3rd Foot Guards arrived under the command of Captain Jamieson. The prisoner was among those arrested. The Crown's first witness is John Cooper.
Black Jack testified that he went downriver to Rochester to buy coal that had been unloaded there. He had it driven to London in carts.
Mac asked, "Who did the ship belong to?"
"I don't know. I dealt with the captain."
"Where was the ship from?"
"Edinburgh."
"Could it have belonged to Sir George Jamieson?"
"I don't know."
"Who suggested to you that you might be able to buy coal in Rochester?"
"Sidney Lennox."
"A friend of the Jamiesons?"
"I don't know about that."
Pym's next witness was Roland MacPherson, who swore that he had read the Riot Act at 11:15 in the evening, and the crowd had refused to disperse. Mac said,
"You were on the scene very quickly."
"Yes."
"Who summoned you?"
"Harold Nipper."
"The landlord of the Frying Pan?"
"Yes."
"Did he have far to go?"
"I don't know what you mean."
"Where were you when he summoned you?"
"In the back parlour of his tavern."
"That was handy. Was it planned?"
"I knew there was going to be a coal delivery, and I feared there might be trouble."
"Who forewarned you?"
"Sidney Lennox."
One of the jurors said,
"How?"
Mac looked at him. He was a youngish man with a sceptical expression, and Mac marked him down as a potential ally in the jury. Finally, Pym called Jay Jamieson. Jay talked easily, and the judge looked faintly bored, as if they were friends discussing a matter of no importance. Mac wanted to shout,
"Don't be so casual! My life is at stake!"
Jay said he had been in command of a detachment of guards at the Tower of London. The sceptical juror interrupted.
"What were you doing there?"
Jay looked as if the question had taken him by surprise. He said nothing.
"Answer the question," said the juror.
Jay looked at the judge, who seemed annoyed with the juror, and said with obvious reluctance,
"You must answer the jury's questions, Captain."
"We were there in readiness," Jay said.
"For what?" said the juror.
"In case our assistance was needed in keeping the peace in the eastern part of the city." "Is that your usual barracks?" said the juror.
"No."
"Where then?"
"Hyde Park, at the moment."
"On the other side of London?"
"Yes."
"How many nights have you made this special trip to the Tower?"
"Just one."
"How did you come to be there that particular night?"
"I assume my commanding officers feared trouble."
"Sidney Lennox warned them, I suppose,"
the juror said, and there was a ripple of laughter. Pym continued to question Jay, who said that when he and his men arrived at the coal yard, there was a riot in full progress, which was true. He told how Mac had attacked him, also true, and had been knocked out by another soldier.
Mac asked him, "What do you think of coal heavers who riot?"
"They are breaking the law and should be punished."
"Do you believe most folk agree with you, by and large?"
"Yes."
"Do you think the riot will turn folk against the coal heavers?"
"I'm sure of it."
"So the riot makes it more likely that the authorities will take drastic action to end the strike?"
"I certainly hope so."
Beside Mac, Caspar Gordonson was muttering,
"Brilliant, brilliant, he fell right into your trap."
"And when the strike is over, the Jamieson family's coal ships will be unloaded and you will be able to sell your coal again."
Jay began to see where he was being led, but it was too late.
"Yes,"